good.
But Cooley says that in the caucus they were thinking that if you could get me up here, I would keep my mouth shut on the tax bill.
He mentioned, somebody mentioned that.
Before you get started.
And.
Mr. President, Senator Pogrebiller.
Mr. President, I move that further proceedings under the roll call be dispensed with and the Sergeant-at-Arms be instructed to bring in absent members.
On the motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Today's chaplain is Reverend Sharon Predovich from the Resurrection Life Church in Eden Prairie.
Serbian or Croatian or Romanian?
Serbian.
Serbian, yeah. Kako si, Dobran.
Oh, I don't know that one.
All right.
But that's my husband.
Okay.
I'm Finnish. Welcome. I'm glad to see so many women here. That's wonderful. Heavenly Father, as we come before you today, humble in attitude, submitted in will, we ask you to pour out your spirit of grace and power in our state and in our lives. We ask for a revival of truth, mercy, and love for all mankind by creating in us a pure heart and a renewed spirit within us. Guide our individual choices, enlighten our minds and hearts to creative wisdom, and teach us your truths. May the authority you have given us be used for your purposes. May we remember it is our responsibility to make decisions that advance mankind and enhance our state. God bless Minnesota, our decision-making today, and our people throughout the state. May your will be done. We pray. Amen.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Bless you. Where are you from?
South St. Paul.
Oh, okay.
I'd like to comment, but I better not. Secretary will take the roll.
Anderson, Bach, Berglund, Betzold, Bonoff, Carlson, Chaudhry, Clark, Cullen, Day, Dibble, Dill, Dahl, Erickson, Ropes, Fishbach, Foley, Fredrickson, Gerlach, Gimsey, Han, Higgins, Ingebrigtsen, Johnson, Youngbauer, Koch, Coring, Kubli, Langseth, Larson, Latz, Limmer, Laurie, Lynch, Marty, Metzen, Michelle, Moi, Murphy, Neville, Olsen, Olson G, Olson M, Ortman, Pappas, Parisot, Pogemiller, Bretner Solon, Rest, Roebling, Rosen, Rummel, Saltzman, Saxhog, Scheid, Senjum, Sharon, Sieben, Skoy, Skogan, Sparks, Stumpf, Tomasoni, Torres Ray, Vandeveer, Vickerman, Wergen, and Wigger. Quorum is present.
Quorum is present. First order of business is executive and official communications.
The Honorable James Metzen, President of the Senate. Dear President Metzen, I have vetoed and am returning Senate File 1989, the Omnibus Higher Education Funding Act.
Senator.
Mr. President, I move that Senate File 1989 and the veto message thereon be laid on the table.
On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Next order of business is messages from the House.
Mr. President, I have the honor to announce the passage by the House of the following Senate files herewith returned. Senate files 322, 744, 1464, 1705, 1902, 2030, 2161, 585, 998, and 1557. Signed, Alvin A. Mathewicz, Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives.
No. Thanks.
And, Mr. President, I have the honor to announce the passage by the House of the following Senate file as amended by the House, in which amendments the concurrence of the Senate is respectfully requested. Senate File 538, a bill for an act related to state government establishing a heating and cooling policy for building projects funded with state appropriations. Senate File 538 is herewith returned to the Senate. Signed, Alvin A. Mathewicz, Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives.
Senator Kubli.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. I would move that the Senate concur in the amendments to Senate File 538 and that the bill be on its repassage as amended.
Okay, the changes could be found in the Journal of April 27th, page number 4839. Senator Kubli, explain to the Senate the differences of the bill, in the bill?
Well, Mr. President and members, this bill had a requirement that the state, when looking at...
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. President. This bill was a requirement that the state take a look at geothermal as a possibility for heating and cooling when government buildings are looking at replacing their boilers and their air conditioning systems anyway. But the House added an amendment that would ask that they look at solar thermal possibilities in addition to the geothermal ones, and so that was the primary change to the bill. Other than that, I guess I have no objection to asking that they look at the solar thermal possibilities as well, but that's the primary difference.
Any further discussion on Senate File 538, Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kubley, would you yield?
He will yield, Senator Roebling.
Senator Kubley, I was very supportive of the proposal as it ended up going out of the Senate, but I couldn't hear your explanation of what the House did to it or how they changed it, because I know that the cities and counties, a lot of people were concerned about the bill as introduced, and you modified it, amended it, and I'm wondering if the House did pretty much the same thing or if it's pretty much like the bill as introduced.
All right. Part of the problem here, Senator Roebling, is there's too much noise here. Senator Kubley, we're going to try it again. I think he gave an explanation that I heard. But go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. Senator Roebling, the primary difference is that the House added solar thermal in addition to the geothermal as something that needs to be considered when government is looking at replacing heating and cooling systems in buildings. You know, so from my perspective, I have no objection to them doing that, I guess. So, you know, if that's an objection of yours, well, that's fine. But, you know, I guess I think it's fine the way it is, and I'm willing to take it.
Further discussion on Senate File 538, seeing none, the Secretary will give the bill. It's Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kubley, I'm sorry, I just haven't been able to get it up fast enough from the House version. Is it still that they must consider it as an option? It's still that they just must consider it as an option. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Senator Kubley renews his motion that the Senate concur in the amendments by the House to Senate File 538 and the bill be placed on its repassage as amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Third reading of Senate File 538.
Senate File 538, a bill for an act relating to state government establishing a heating and cooling policy for building projects funded with state appropriations.
Secretary will take the roll. Rick. All senators having voted desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. Senator Cohn votes aye. There being 63 ayes, 0 nays. The bill is passed and it's title agreed to.
And, Mr. President, I have the honor to announce the passage by the House of the following Senate file as amended by the House, in which amendments the concurrence of the Senate is respectfully requested. Senate File 1165, a bill for an act relating to the open meeting law, authorizing meetings by telephone or other electronic means under certain conditions. Senate File 1165 is herewith returned to the Senate. Signed, Albany Mathewis, Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives.
Senator Olcine.
Mr. President, I concur in the amendments by the House to Senate File 1165 and that the bill be placed on its repassage as amended. The changes can be seen in the Senate House Journal on May 9th on page 6230 and 6231. Mr. President, members, the changes are, there's just two changes. One is a spelling correction, and one is on line 2, or page 2, line 29, they added an individual's. So then the sentence would read, an individual's medical records governed by section 144.335. That's the only changes in the bill.
Discussion, Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Olcine, it would also help us if you reminded us what the bill did beyond what the changes are. I don't remember, the changes are nice, but I don't know what the bill does.
Senator Olcine.
Mr. President, Senator Betzel, thank you. This is a bill that allows electronic emergency meetings for public meetings in case of a flu pandemic or other kinds of emergencies, that public meetings may be held from remote locations in case the members of a city council, school board, or county board could not come to the centralized meeting place because of whatever condition.
Senator Betzel.
And then, Mr. President, Senator Olcine, then what are the effects of the amendments? How does that change the bill as it comes back from the House?
Senator Olcine.
Mr. President, Senator Betzel, the first change, we had spelled health wrong, so they just corrected the spelling of health. And the second change, when it talks to regards to medical records, there was a concern that if medical records, the way it was worded originally, that nobody could go after anybody's medical records. So by saying an individual's medical records, that meant that a county could look at an individual's. But the way it had been originally worded, that those records, the county couldn't look at the records. So it was just cleaning up the language, that it was just a little piece that we had missed.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would Senator Olcine yield for a question?
Able yield.
Senator Olcine, your recent comments raises one question, but I had another question. You and I had a discussion on the floor of the Senate as this was passing concerning whether or not there's any available record once these closed-door meetings occur. You may remember that I raised the question that quite often whenever we have a public governing body that has to have a closed-door meeting, that at least there would be a public record retained somewhere for future review by the public. Sometimes that's dated, sometimes it's a year out that it could be open. We had that discussion as it was being passed. Did the conference committee have any discussion about this? Did you raise that with anyone? At least our verbal concerns that you had agreed with. Did anyone have that discussion? Was it voted on?
Senator Olcine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, sorry. No, but it is addressed under Subdivision 3, where that if the press or anybody wants to get a copy of the documented record of the meeting, it's available, but at their cost. So it is addressed under Subdivision 3.
And Mr. President.
Mr. President.
Senator Pogermiller.
Sir, Limmer, members, I just want to point out, this is not a conference committee report. This is a concurrence, as I understand it. I think there was some this is a concurrence, not a conference committee report.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Senator Pogermiller. Trying to concur with the House, I then have the same concerns, of course. And certainly there was communication between the Senate members and the House members in this concurrence. The concern that some of us had was whether or not there was a record. Apparently there's a written record. Is that a transcribed record, or is that just notes taken by a clerk in this meeting, or would there be a tape recording that would be available to listen?
Senator Olcine.
Mr. President, Senator Limmer, it actually says that a press person could monitor the meeting at the same time that, whether it's electronically, they could be on the same type of monitoring as the officials that would be also connecting to the meeting remotely. So they could be seeing and hearing the meeting if it's televised at the same time as the elected officials.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator.
Thank you, Senator Olsen. The other question that I did have, and that makes reference to the new language regarding our medical data records, Chapter 144 reference that you made. Is this a new request that would be required, or is this clarifying language? And in what context would these officials need medical records?
Senator Olsen.
Mr. President, Senator Limmer, the concern had been the way it was originally drafted that if a county wanted to, for whatever reason, look at a medical record, we had actually forbidden that. So by adding the word an individual, that means that for whatever reason, in the context of this emergency, they could then look at the person's medical records if it's a flu pandemic or something like that. So it's a very small change, but it's a significant change because it allows a change in language that would have restricted this to allow it, but only to look at an individual's medical record that would be related to the emergency.
And Mr. President, Senator Olsen, are you familiar with what is called the Tennyson warning?
No, I'm not.
Senator
Olsen. Well, Mr. President and Senator Olsen, I don't know the context of this request for medical data, but whenever we have it in existing state law that whenever a state government or any government requests private data from an individual, a Tennyson warning is in place that requires the government to explain why they need that information to the individual that they're requesting information from. I don't know if Chapter 144 reference that you've made reference to requests the Tennyson warning in it or not. And I was just hoping that perhaps in this concurrence that there was at least some discussion as we stray into release of medical data records, personal, private data, that at least that Tennyson warning would be required.
Mr. President, Senator Limmer, one thing about the releasing of the medical records, it's only when a meeting is closed, so it would be under a closed meeting that an individual's medical records would be discussed. But I'm not sure about the Tennyson warning. I'm sure that that might be under 144. I haven't looked at that.
Further discussions, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would Senator Olsen yield for just one question?
He will yield, Senator Senjum.
Senator Olsen, I've been sort of on the outside of this one, but I was drawn to the discussion by some of Senator Limmer's comments with respect to the medical record. In any discussion about that medical record, would it be understood that the patient would have had to sign a release form before that could be discussed by other people, even in a closed meeting?
Senator Olsen.
Mr. President, Senator Senjum, I believe that this whole bill is in case of an emergency, if it is a flu pandemic or a flood or something like that. So the context of somebody discussing a medical record would probably be related to a flu pandemic. And in an emergency situation, there may not be a time. It would be a closed meeting, though, where medical records would be discussed. So I think the context would be like if something's going on, there's a flu pandemic, somebody's records are being looked at for the history of possible disease or carrying this flu pandemic, that it would be in a closed meeting. This language is kind of added, well, when this language was added, after we had moved on it, then it had come forward that if we didn't add an individual's records, then that would mean that the medical records would have been closed completely. So an individual's records was added. So that's, I don't know if that gets to your concern, but it's to look at somebody's record in the light of this emergency, whether it's a flu pandemic or some other sort of emergency.
Mr. President,
Senator Senja.
For me, at least, it's simply a life experience where the medical record is almost a sacred document, and it is held in strictest confidence, lest a release form is procured. And I would have concerns about that within this bill, the release of any medical information off a medical record unless a release form was properly executed.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Olsen renews his motion that the Senate concur in the amendments by the House to Senate File 1165 and that the bill be placed on its repassage as amended. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. President. With all due respect to Senator Olsen and the work that he's done, I have some concerns and questions about whether we've had a strong enough discussion now that the bill is now going in a new or expanded direction. And I would recommend that we recommend that it goes to conference committee so the concerns of data privacy and medical records are met in a responsible way. Not to say that it hasn't been, but I think we need to have a little more information. And I would recommend a no vote at this time.
On the Senator Betzel.
Well, Mr. President, members, it appears that this bill passed the Senate on April 18th by a vote of 65 to nothing. And it really is not a data practices issue. It's more of an open meeting law bill that clarifies information that can be exchanged during an emergency. As I looked at the House Journal, there were two amendments. One was that the word health was misspelled. It was H-E-A-T-H in the bill, and it was corrected to H-E-A-L-T-H. That was one of the House amendments. And the other amendment says instead of referring to medical records generically to an individual's medical records, which I think was the intent of the bill. So I think that both amendments were fairly minor from the House, and we're asking to concur in those. I don't think that going to a conference committee is going to do that. Now, perhaps it might be appropriate if Senator Limmer or others want a bit more time to look at the House amendments. It might be more appropriate for Senator Olsen to table the bill to give people a look at that, but just from what I've been able to look at, I don't think that we really need to look at a conference committee. But I do respect the fact that some people may want to spend a little bit more time and look at this before they vote. But the bill is pretty much the same as far as I can see from what passed this chamber on by a 65 to nothing vote on April 18th.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would Senator Betzold yield for a question?
He will yield. Senator Limmer.
Senator Betzold, Mr. President, Senator Betzold, the earlier draft of the bill that didn't state the word individual health records, but just simply medical records of some sort, gave me the appearance that it was more aggregate data and not detailed information once the word individual comes in. That's why the concern is here that simple change does raise a little bit more focus on exactly what kind of records there are. Is the term making reference to an individual's records, does that, in your opinion, open this door a little bit more to more intimate medical records of an individual and not so much aggregate data?
Senator Betzel.
Well, Mr. President, Senator Limmer, The reference is to medical records governed by Section 144.335. I don't have that in front of me, and I don't remember the discussion on that, which is probably a little more reason why, again, if Senator Olsen, I would suggest may want to table the bill so that you can take another look at it, and I can look at the section, too, to see where it's at. But I think that, you know, maybe if we just take a look at what the bill says and does, but I think that... You know, my reading of it right now would be a more narrow interpretation, but I'd have to double-check what 144.335 actually says. But, I suggest that Senator Olsen consider tabling the bill and give us a chance to take a look at that.
Are you suggesting, Senator Moi?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I think that what the when I saw the language, it didn't alarm me that much from a data privacy perspective, Senator Limmer, because the way the amendment was, and the reason why we didn't see it was because the amendment was put on in state and local government. But when it came to the floor, I took a look at that, and the reason why it didn't alarm me too much is because what the amendment did is it's saying that they can go into a close meeting to talk about the data. And so I felt like there was more protection. The process gave the private information more protection. And so I think in substance, the way the process is, gives the private data more protection. I know that you're a very thoughtful member of the data practices group, and I know that in this instance you want to protect the private data and make sure that we're not creating opportunities for that to be put out there, but that's the effect.
I think we ought to table this for a while and try to make people comfortable if we can. Why do that? All right. Do what you want to do. Senator Olsen.
Mr. President.
The first motion has been withdrawn. Senator?
Yes. I would move that the Senate do not concur with the amendments by the House file and Senate file 1165 and that a conference committee of three members be appointed by the subcommittee on conference committees on the part of the Senate to act like a conference committee appointed on the part of the House.
On the motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Yes.
Mr. President, I then announce the House has acceded the request of the Senate for the appointment of a conference committee consisting of three members of the House on the amendments adopted by the House of the following Senate file number 26, a bill for an act related to health occupations, extending the expiration dates for the Board of Medical Practices Advisory Councils. There has been appointed as such committee on the part of the House Representatives Tao, Murphy, E., and Abler. Senate file number 26 is herewith returned to the Senate. Alban A. Mather is Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives. And, Mr. President, I have the honor to announce the passage by the House of the following House file herewith transmitted, House File 1781.
Okay, the next order of business is first reading of House bills. There's one on today's agenda, printed on today's agenda. Be referred to the committee as indicated. Without objection, first reading of House bills. The next order of business, reports of committees. There's one to be read at the desk.
Senator Pogermiller from the Committee on Rules Administration, which was referred House File 116 for comparison with the companion Senate file, reports the following House file was found not identical with the companion Senate file. On general orders, House File 116 with Senate File 162, pursuant to Rule 45, the committee recommends the House file be amended. And when so amended, the House file be identical to the Senate file, recommends the House file be given a second reading substitute for the Senate file, and the Senate file be indefinitely postponed.
Senator Pogermiller.
President, I move that the committee report printed in today's agenda, as well as the report read by the Secretary, be adopted.
On the motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Next order of business is second reading of House bills. We have House File 1758 and House File 116.
House File number 116.
Without objection, second reading of House bills. Next order of business is motions and resolutions. There are a number of resolutions here. Without objection, they will be sent to the Rules Committee.
Mr. President.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks. I had a motion as well. And I've spoken with Senator Pogemiller as well as the ranking member on this. I'm moving that the appointments withdrawn from the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources and placed on the confirmation calendar under Senate Rule 8.2, reported in the Journal for May 7, 2007, be returned to the committee from which they were withdrawn. Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, Alfred Berner, Nancy Gibson, David Hartwell, John Hunt, and Mary Mueller, to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Don Scheffelbein, to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Members, it's our intent to hear these confirmations. There are no issues. We just simply, with all the work we did, the 60-day rule ran out, and so they were automatically returned to, sent to the confirmation calendar, so we're just asking that they be sent back to committee so we can have a hearing.
Mr. President.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, Senator Chaudhry, the intent is to hear that in the next few days, correct?
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. President, Senator Pogemiller, yes.
Senator Wergen. Senators. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. President. It does concern me a little bit that under 8.2 we have a 60-day deadline for hearing these confirmations. And now we brought them to the floor according to our rules, and we're going to send them back to committee. It begs the question why we have a rule in the first place if we're going to disregard it and then send something back. And Senator Chaudhry mentioned that there is no problem with these appointments, so I assume it would have taken a very short portion of a committee meeting simply to confirm these people and move them from committee to the floor. I would appreciate hearing from Senator Chaudhry that, just to have him repeat, that he does not anticipate a problem and that he does anticipate hearing these confirmation appointments within the next couple days, Mr. President. Thank you.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. President, Senator Wergen, because of the different deadlines that we had and the number of appointments that the Environment Committee had, we spent a day on the Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources as well as a day on the Commissioner of the MPCA. But then we also had another day of confirmation hearings for the newly appointed Clean Water Legacy Council that was appointed by the governor, and that was about 18 people, and the LCCMR is another 5 people, and the PCA is another 4 people. We only have the one here because the 60 days only ran out on this one person. So there were quite a number of appointments that we needed to review for confirmation, in addition to all the other committee work that we did in the policy committee. So, I don't think there were any issues with this, but Senator Wergen, I don't anticipate any, but that's the reason for the hearings, to ask these people questions. And I think it's probably more important that the committee have the opportunity to do that than simply say we're going to confirm them without a hearing. And I'm making this motion, and this is for the body to support or not support. So we're can certainly choose not to support it if you want, but I think it would probably be the prudent thing to do.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. President. What I'm wondering about, and I've got the rule book here, and of course we have the 60-day rule, but would this not be not unlike, for instance, missing a bill deadline? In this case, it's a confirmation deadline, and would it not be more appropriate under the rules that this go to the Rules Committee And then, you know, we can pass it out of that and allow Senator Chaudhary to proceed. But procedurally, wouldn't it be something for the Rules Committee to deal with, just as it would deal with any so-called past deadline?
Mr. President?
Senator Chaudhary.
Thank you. Senator Senjum, it may appear like that, but I think the rules refer to, with regards to passing a deadline, being referred to the rules, that's regards to bills. This is a confirmation, and confirmations are not subject to the deadlines. If you recall, we actually heard the two commissioner confirmations after the policy deadline. So I'm not sure that the rule for the policy, the deadline issue, actually applies here. That's not to say that the Senate can't pass something like that in the future or apply it, but I don't think that same thing applies here because they already don't apply to the bill deadlines.
Mr. President?
Senator Senjum.
And this is not meant in any way to be a harassing kind of question, but, you know, it does seem to me that we do have, in my mind, a 60-day deadline, not unlike a bill, and that we do have procedures for dealing with past things that we do that go past deadline, and it seems it just ought to go through the Rules Committee, and we'll probably move it forward. It would be no problem, I suspect, but it seems to me we just ought to act procedurally on these kind of things, and if we start getting kind of going away from that, I think we lose the form of the Senate, and I think that's important.
They've been on the confirmation calendar for some time. Senator Betzel?
Well, Mr. President, as I recall the history of this, there was some concern when I believe, for instance, the DNR commissioner under Governor Carlson served 8 years, and there was never a hearing in committee on that because the then committee chair, Senator Lessard, says that he later explained that Governor Carlson did not want one, but there were some concerns at that time. As I recall, Senator Dan Stevens then proposed a change to the Senate rules so that a single committee chair could not bottle up an appointment and just basically sit on it, and the Senate would never vote on it. So the Senate went along with that and adopted a proposal that would have a time limit to bring the appointments to the floor if a committee did not act on them. Now, there's no requirement that the Senate actually do vote on them or do anything once they get to the floor, but the idea was that the individual committee chair could not just sit on that. That rule was modified earlier this year simply because the rule had been for 1 year, and you could wind up with a situation where maybe a governor made an appointment very late in 1 year's legislative session, say in the odd-numbered year, and then we would come back in the even-numbered year, and the year would have passed, and really the legislature would have not really had much time to look at it. So it was changed to the 60 legislative days, not calendar days, but legislative days, so that which would time out to be maybe about the same period of time, but since we've burned off a lot of legislative days this year, I guess it's moved a little quicker. But I don't know what sending it to the Rules Committee would accomplish, because the Rules Committee is sort of like the traffic cop to decide where things are supposed to go, and if it goes to the Rules Committee would either bounce it back to the floor or send it to the Committee of Jurisdiction. So I think that the decision is right before us now. We can make the decision. We don't need the Rules Committee to do that. We decide that if we want to have the matter sent back to the Committee of Jurisdiction so that there can be a public hearing, so if anybody has any issues or questions from the public, they can raise them at that point. That's appropriate. It's either going to be on the floor or the committee, but again, the floor doesn't have to take them up. And I'd frankly like the public to weigh in if the public has any concerns, and that would be done. I think it's appropriate that it be done this session. I think it has to be done before we adjourn, and Senator Chaudhary has indicated that is his intention. So I don't see what the difficulty is in sending these appointments back to the committee, having the policy committee have the hearing on them, and then send them back to the floor, and then we'll see where we go from there.
Senator Senjum.
Mr. President, and I don't want to belabor this, but what I want to do, in order to kind of get a decision out of the chair, I want to move this to the Rules Committee. You can move whether that's out of order or not if you want to, but just to try to bring finality to this. I think as I read this that an appointment referred to the committee and not reported to the Senate within 60 days after it was re-referred is withdrawn from the committee and placed on the confirmation calendar for full Senate consideration. Seems to me we ought to be considering these appointments today. If we don't, it seems to me that the Rules Committee ought to engage and decide on this.
All right. That all right? Okay. What we're going to do is Senator Senjum amends the Chaudhry motion to withdrawn from the committee to the Committee on Environmental and Natural Resources. It's going to go to the Rules Committee. That's the
Mr.
amendment.
Mr. President.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, I've in conversations with Senator Chaudhry and with Senator the minority leader, Senator Senjum, I think fine. I think we should support Senator Senjum's motion. And then I think what would happen in the Rules Committee is there'd be a discussion about whether the Rules Committee felt that the Policy Committee was actually going to take up the confirmations. And I think that's fine. I don't think that's a problem.
All right. Is that all right, Senator Chaudhry?
Mr. President, I'll accept that. Okay. Amendment is friendly.
The motion is to amend your motion. So all in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Now we're on the Chaudhry motion as amended, which be referred to the Rules and Administration Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Without objection, still under motions, we'll go to Senate bill introductions. There are a few printed on today's agenda. Without objection, first reading of Senate bills. Are we going to go right to the tax bill now? Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, members, apparently we are not going to take up the smoke-free bill today, the conference committee report. So I believe that frees up some time. We are going to special rule House File 2294 out of the Tax Committee yesterday. But why don't we, and we will do that next, but why don't we take up some confirmations today? And so if the chairs would listen of those committees, here's the ones that I would propose we take up today. I would think we could take up the Commissioner of Health. We could take up Housing Finance Agency. We could take up, there's several housing finance agencies. Could take all those up. Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. We could take up Commissioner of Natural Resources. Pollution Control Agency. Tax Court. Would you be prepared to do that? Maybe we won't take up tax court today. Clean Water Council, Board of Arts, Racing Commission, and Office of Higher Education. So we will take those up after we process Senate House File 2294. So, Mr. President, I would, pursuant to Rule 26, I designate House File Number 2294, Number 42 on General Orders, to be made a special order for immediate consideration.
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. President and members. House File 2294 is kind of a hybrid of a couple of proposals that have been passing through the legislature. But in a nutshell, if I could put it into a soundbite for you, it raises the income tax. It creates a fourth tier by the House number that you've heard about. So it creates a new fourth tier at 9% on joint filers over $400,000 in income, and on head of household filers over $340,000 in income, and on single filers over $226,000 of income. And now, members, remember that is taxable income, so that is not the income that you see on your W-2 statement. This is after you've taken your deductions, so it would be not what you actually feel like you earn on your check, but after all your deductions have been taken. Members, that affects about between 20,000 and 21,000 filers in Minnesota, and about 7,000 filers who are either not residents of the state or who are part-time residents of the state. That raises about $452 million per biennium. So what we then do with the $452 million is we put every dime, and let me say that again, every dime of the income tax increase is put into property tax relief. And it's done in two ways. It's done through a proposal that was developed in the House. They are characterizing it as the supercharged property tax refund. It is a proposal where, similar to the current circuit breaker program we have in law, but it's enhanced in that the general soundbite on it is that if your property taxes are more than 2% of your income, the state is going to pick up a share of your property taxes. They're actually going to cut you a check back for a portion of the share that your property taxes are over 2% of your income. And depending on what your income is, that share you're going to get back is larger. If you're very low income, you're going to get probably up to 90% of the property tax portion over 2% back in a check from the state. The percentage you get back as you move up the income ladder, and this actually ends at $150,000 in household income, but if you're between $131,000 and $150,000, if your property taxes are more than 2% of your income, you would get 25% of that difference back. So it is it operates very similar to the current program that we have on the circuit breaker. That costs $223 million. Now, members need to know that is direct relief to homeowners. That doesn't reduce their property tax liability. Their statement will be the same, but they will be able to apply for a refund and receive it back. The check will go directly to the property owner. Oftentimes the criticism of us doing local government aid or program aid to counties is all those savings aren't actually passed through to the property taxpayers, but $223 million of direct relief to homeowners. And then the balance of the money, because I told you it raises $452 million, the balance of the money in the bill is spent on four different education levy buy-downs. We are And members, I think we all are concerned about the level of the growing dependence on property taxes to fund schools. And what this is an effort, in addition to the direct relief to homeowners, it's an effort to buy down some of the school levies that we have here in Minnesota. So what we do by buying those levies down is we switch those levies that are levied on property, we shift it to state aid. So what we end up doing in this bill is not only buying down the property tax, but turn the property tax into state aid for schools. And in this biennium, the levy buy-down is about $109 million of less property taxes that would have gone to school funding, and that is changed to an aid. Now, and that breaks down in four different categories that were that were buying those local school levies down. The first one is something called the operating capital levy, and that, members, used to be all aid. Prior to the 2003 session, and I think most of us were here in 2003 and went through the budget crisis. Prior to that, this was all aid. It was not levy at all. And the governor proposed and the legislature passed changing it to a levy. So that's the newest levy that we've imposed on schools that prior to 2003 was an aid. It's called the operating capital levy, and what it pays for capital expenditures at your school. If the school needs to buy textbooks or maybe new desks or do some minor maintenance on the school building, they go to the operating, to the capital levy to do that. We buy that down by about a little over $57 million. The other buy-down of levy is in the voter-approved operating levies, and I think most of us are familiar with that. I believe of the 350 school districts that we have, I think there's only about 30 that don't have some kind of a voter-approved operating referendum passed. And we spend about $21.5 million to change that formula to put more aid in and buy down some of that levy. And then there's a third levy buy down, and it's on ag land. You know, we hear about the homestead and 1 acre on ag land. When schools go out for a capital bond issue, ag land is part of the bond to help pay for a new school. And with growing agricultural prices across the state in the ag areas, a larger and larger burden of school bond levy referendums are being picked up by agricultural properties. So in ag areas of the state, and I don't represent one, I have very little agriculture in my district, but some of our legislators that represent farm areas could probably speak to this probably a little more accurately than I could, but as I understand it, as the ag property goes up in value, more of the burden of the school bond levy is shifted to the agricultural property, and what's happening is there's starting to become a pretty strong movement in some of the areas of the state where we have a lot of ag property. It's getting very, very difficult to pass capital levy referendums in some of those school districts. So there's $18 million in here to help buy down some of the impact on ag property in those districts that have a lot of ag land. The fourth and final levy reduction is in the debt service equalization aid program. That's a program where we have a formula where if you have low tax capacity, the state will pick up some of the cost of buying down the debt on your new school construction. And a lot of schools in the state participate in this. This enhances that formula some so that we pick up a larger share of the debt service on school districts that don't have a lot of tax capacity. And that is about $12.5 million of reduced levy and increased aid to those school districts. So members, that's really a snapshot of what this is about. There is $452 million of income tax increase in this bill, and there is a corresponding reduction in property taxes, either directly to the homeowner or in a levy, school levy buy-down in one of four areas. So members, I think it would be unfair to characterize this as a tax increase because this bill is tax neutral. It raises income taxes, lowers property taxes by the same amount, and this is an effort on my part to try and make our tax system slightly more progressive. We have a regressive system today. This will make it a little bit less regressive than it is today by reducing property taxes and increasing income taxes. But just remember, when you're talking to constituents at home, I do not think this is fair to characterize this as a tax increase, because it's not. Because in total, all of the income tax money raised in this bill is spent to buy down property taxes. So members, that is the extent of it. It's a pretty small little bill. We're hoping that that the House will find their way to agree to this. Much of this are provisions that were contained in the House tax bill and worked its way through their committees. And members, I'd appreciate your support.
Is there further discussion on House File 2294? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. President. Madam President, excuse me, would Senator Bach yield?
Senator Bach, would you yield for a question? He yields.
Madam President, before I yield, I have a staff, my very good tax staff reminded me I have a very technical amendment. If I could put that on first, Senator Ortman.
Senator Ortman.
Of course.
Senator Bach.
Madam President, I have the A5 amendment.
Senator Bach offers the A5 amendment. The Secretary will report the A5 amendment.
Senator Bach moves to amend House File 2294, the unofficial engrossment, as follows. Page 11, line 17. This is the A-5 amendment.
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, this is a technical correction. The number on the spreadsheet is the right number. The number in the bill is slightly off, so this is just a technical correction on the number to match up with the spreadsheet for fiscal year 2011. I appreciate your support.
Is there further discussion of the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. Will Senator Bach yield?
Senator Bach, do you yield? Yes, he does. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President, and Senator Bach. I'm wondering, can you just maybe go over whether or not this bill, if it were passed into law, would create some kind of permanent tax relief? Is it intended to be permanent in nature, and where would the funds for that come from? If there's growth in the local government, schools, counties, and cities.
Senator Bach.
Well, thank you, Madam President. Senator Ortman, this is permanent. We permanently change the property tax relief program we have in law and insert this new table for people. And I passed out, or Senator Scoy, I believe, passed out a sheet of some kind of sample households with sample incomes and sample property taxes on their homes and how some model homesteads would look as far as the relief they would see. The changes in the PTR program are permanent, so this would be the new schedule that people, if their income stayed the same and their property taxes stayed the same, they could count on a check like that every year. And then on the levy side, those changes in the equalizing formula on the levies is permanent. So unless schools went out and raised the levy, their school taxes would stay the same. But even if schools did raise the levy further from where it's at today, the state would be picking up a larger portion than it does under current law.
Senator Ortman.
Madam President, that was exactly what I thought was happening here. We're making permanent changes in our tax structure and permanent changes in the relationship between the state of Minnesota and its funding for state and local, or excuse me, for local government operations. And I would ask if Senator Bach could yield for another question.
Senator Bach, do you yield? He does. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. And Senator Bach, we're making a permanent change here. The local governments, as you said, could raise their levies. They could raise their spending. Are there any limits to how much they can raise their levies? Is there any kind of cap on increasing local government spending that correlates to your permanent takeover by the state of funding the functions of local government?
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Ortman. The criticism that I often hear from people, and they're not only people on your side of the aisle, Senator Ortman, I certainly hear them from the governor and even from some members of my caucus, is sometimes programs like local government aid or aid to counties, some people say that sometimes it's not fair to characterize that as tax relief because it just encourages more spending at the local level. So what we've put together here is a proposal by which other than the levies for schools, and I think we all agree we're getting too reliant on property taxes to fund schools. That portion, I think we all agree as a matter of public policy, would be good to try and get away from and try to restore, the state's commitment to fund schools with state general fund money. And the other part of it, because of the criticism about local government aid not being property tax relief, I was hoping that people would find a way to support this if the aid went directly to the homeowner. Didn't go to the local unit of government, so the local unit of government had an opportunity to spend part of the money. The aid would go directly to the homeowner. So I guess in answer to your question, Senator Ortman, there is no help in this bill for local units of government. And local units of government, depending on what their tax capacity is, what the needs in their community are, maybe if their tax capacity is increasing or not, they make those levy decisions at the local level, and they're held accountable for that. But there is not a cap on potential levy increases. There's not a property tax freeze. That may be something that we consider, depending on discussions go with the governor, on the omnibus tax bill, but it's not in the bill in front of you today. It doesn't do anything to repair, I think, a pretty damaged relationship between state and local governments. I think the relationship was damaged quite a bit in 2003 when we cut a lot of aid to local units of government, and you could even back up further than that. I remember in the 2001 tax bill, we took all of the aid that went to townships. I think it was like $29 million that went to townships. We took it all away. We wiped it out in the 2001 bill and told them, you just go ahead and levy it back, townships. So it really goes back further than Governor Plenty. It happened under Governor Ventura in 2001 when we did some major property tax reform, in that we really severed our relationship with township government in 2001. So rather than try some kind of a little Band-Aid approach to restore that state and local fiscal relationship, what I think needs to be done. But I think that is a separate issue from providing direct property tax relief to homeowners. This bill doesn't repair that state-local fiscal relationship, but I do hope that the omnibus tax bill that comes out of Room 15 here over the next 12 days, I hope that it does go down the road of restoring some of the state's responsibility to help local governments provide for public services.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President, and Senator Bach. I'm wondering if Senator Bach would yield further discussion.
Senator Bach, he yields. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. My next question is about two homeowners in one community. If two homeowners both have million-dollar homes, one family working hard makes $500,000 a year, they're going to pay income taxes and property taxes without any refund on the property taxes.
neighboring home, $1 million, nobody working in that house, they don't pay, they get a refund. They don't earn income tax, they don't pay to the state because they don't have any income, and they also don't pay property taxes for the same services in that community. Is that true?
Senator Bach.
Well, Madam President, Senator Ortman, the whole property tax refund program is intended to address that very thing that you're getting at, in that if your property taxes are high in relation to your income, then the state helps you with that. And I would argue that a whole lot of people probably are in a little more expensive home than they probably can afford. And I think we all know people in our communities, maybe we're doing it ourselves. And through the property tax refund program, you know, to some degree, we probably encourage people maybe with a little state contribution to help buy down their property taxes. And I mean, that's a reasonable criticism of the property tax relief program, is maybe sometimes we help people get a little bit beyond what they can afford. It's not the only area we do that, much like the mortgage interest deduction. You know, nobody's proposing to get rid of it, but it's not the best policy in the world. I mean, we encourage people to incur mortgage debt so the state can pick up part of the cost of it. And so we shift part of that mortgage interest to the state, because when they do their income taxes, they can itemize. So there's a number of areas. Property tax refund, you could argue, is one of them. You could argue that the mortgage interest deduction is one of them, where we probably help people maybe live in a little more house than they probably really can afford.
Senator Ortman.
Madam President, thank you. To me, this looks like a disincentive to hard work, because if you work hard in Minnesota and you make a good income and you live in a nice house, you get punished twice. We're going to raise your income tax level, and you're going to pay for property taxes when the person next door who doesn't have income won't pay for their services. They'll get a refund. And so I think that we're going in the wrong direction here, Madam President. I would ask members in the chamber and members of the community who are watching what we're doing with our tax policy in the state of Minnesota that you join me in taking off the rose-colored glasses today. This is not a good policy for the state of Minnesota, nor is it really property tax relief. You know, a few years ago, we talked about buying down the school levies, and we called it the Minnesota Miracle. I would say that if the state takes over funding for local property taxes, takes over funding for our schools, our counties, and our cities, we should call it the Minnesota Mistake. This is a terrible mistake, Madam President, for the state of Minnesota to take income taxes that we raise at the state level and subsidize the functions of local government, because then we give up the accountability. Then we interfere with the relationship between our local elected officials and the people that they tax. Now they can tax at will, and the state will come to the rescue and will put money into the bottom line for them. So there's no limit on their spending. There are no caps, there are no levy limits. They can spend whatever they want. State of Minnesota and the income generators will come to the rescue, because we'll just keep raising the income taxes every time we need more to pay for local government. There's no accountability, there's no check. Madam President, this is the Minnesota Mistake, and I hope that this chamber will vote it down today.
Senator Bach.
Madam President, Senator Ortman, I don't think you intended this, but I think to people watching on TV, it might have come across wrong, what you said. You know, this morning, on my way in to work, my wife and I stopped at a restaurant on Payne Avenue, where we stop from time to time, and there were two waitresses and one cook in the kitchen. And Senator Ortman, they were all working really, really hard. You know, it's not only people that make $500,000 that work hard. Matter of fact, I would argue that low-income people working at the minimum wage or barely above are working damn harder than people making $500,000. A lot of them are working two jobs, got the kids working. Both spouses are working. They're working their tails off to keep up. And I don't think anybody in this body thinks that they're not working hard. So I just want to be real clear to the people watching. Those of you that are at the minimum wage, I don't think anybody in this Senate thinks that the only people that work hard are people that make $500,000.
Senator Bach, I'm going to remind you to respect the body with regard to your use of language. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. I value hard work, whether you're at home with your children, or you're a grandmother watching your children, whether you get paid or not, I value hard work. And there are so many hardworking Minnesotans. There's no question here that Minnesotans are working hard. My question is this sustainable? It is not. Because local governments will raise their spending, and then who will pay? It is the people that are hardworking, paying income taxes to the state. Sure, we can protect them in a short-lived way from property taxes, but this is not property tax relief. It turns into an overburden on income taxes, and so we're just going to shift the burden. Minnesota taxpayers will pay. Hard-working Minnesota taxpayers at every single level will pay for this. And it's a terrible mistake for us to just open up the checkbook and tell local governments that they should spend whatever they'd like, because the state and the income earners who pay revenue over to the state will fund it. It's a terrible Minnesota mistake.
Senator Day. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam President. And members, Senator Ortman has talked about local governments and counties in her discussion, and let me assure you that nothing in this bill has anything to do with local units of government or counties. As Senator Bach has said, that is in the conference committee report. The provisions in this bill are the property tax refund program. It's been very successful at giving property tax reductions or relief to Minnesotans. The levy buy-down is directly related to our schools. The operating capital provision that is in this bill was all aid in 2003. We are restoring some of that aid that was taken away in 2003. But there's no impact on our local units of governments. That's in the conference committee that we're working on. This is levy reduction for schools and property tax relief to individual Minnesotans.
Is there further discussion on House File 2294, Senator Michelle? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Michelle, Senator Day. Senator Day.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Bach is my good friend, and I thought better. You know, it's been 26 years we had, I can't remember, Tower and Cook or close up there, and then we had Senator Pogemiller. So we've had 26 years of pretty good tax policy. But let me tell you what, this one is the ultimate bait and switch. This is the ultimate bait and switch. You know, as one of the famous people said, government is a little bit like a baby, an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. Well, that's this. You know, if we're serious, we would cap property taxes. If we really wanted to do something, we'd cap property taxes, but or we'd at least put a freeze on, and we're not up to that. I know the Speaker in the House said yesterday that with plenty's budget, property taxes will go up $500 million. Where'd she get that number? How does she know it'll go up $500 million? That was an interesting statement. And we also, we love to hate the property taxes. Democrats have repeatedly pointed out that they've gone up almost $2 billion during the Plenty administration. Well, Democrats are also very, very careful not to mention that property values have went up $139 billion in the state of Minnesota. We rank about 20th to 24th in property taxes across the United States. 20th to 24th. But let me tell you some interesting things, and I thought I would dig them up just because I thought, hey, we're talking property taxes. We're talking bait and switch. We're even getting rid of the homestead credit tax in this bill. Let me give you an example. Let's take Hibbing. Let's take Hibbing. They get in LGA and disparities under this bill $7.4 million. 61% of the entire budget for the city of Hibbing. The LGA already is $7.1 million. They take from taxpayers $4.7 million. I'll get into the schools in a minute. How about Eveleth? Don't want to pick on Tomasoni, but Eveleth, 69% is paid through LGA. 69%. Taxpayers don't have to pay 69%. That's, I don't know, seems steep to me. Two Harbors, 55%. I got Owatonna on here. Don't get nervous. I thought I'd work up north a little bit first. How about Duluth? $26.7 million in Duluth. 71% of everything the city of Duluth spends, we send them. So now what we're going to do is say, hey, Duluth, we're going to send your taxpayers a few dollars. Now think about this. And the city council is going to go say, well, I hope you do, because we're going to go get it. Is that a bait and switch? You tell me. Maybe I'm reading something wrong. 71%. My goodness. Minneapolis, $117 million in LGA. 41% of their budget. They have all the biggest buildings. And, man, I had a chart here. If you don't want to ever come over and look at my... find out where the wealthy people live. We're picking up the 50% of the budget for the where the people are the most richest. And yet we're saying, okay, let's bait and switch them a little bit. Let's send them back a few bucks so the city council can go get it from them again. Crazy. Absolutely. Owatonna, 42% of everything that's spent on the city council in Owatonna, 42%. Now let's look at something else. We talked about schools. Hibbing. You know what the state pays in the schools in the Hibbing? 82% of their budget. 82% of all the schools. Eveleth, 77%. Duluth, 83%. Two Harbors, 69%. Minneapolis, 75%. Owatonna, 76%. Virginia, 75%. So not only in the cities... The taxpayer is paying for all of this. And I'm telling you, if they're sitting out there looking and they think, oh, some good person is going to send them back $200, $300, $400, hang on. This is not Mother Teresa's tax bill. This is going to be out of your pockets. This is going to be out of your pockets. The schools and the cities. It's pretty amazing to me how somebody can come forward and hoodwink the entire state and tell them that if you're living out in a home, some 1% of the people are going to, they're going to all divvy up. And granted, I didn't have an amendment, but I was thinking of an amendment for these 200 people that say we can afford more taxes. My name wasn't on there. In fact, I don't think I know many people on here because I know more of the people that are making $7 an hour than I do anybody that makes $400. I don't know of any. I've never been in a gated community only once in my life. I don't. In Owatonna, we're medium income people. We go to work every day. We do all our things. But I'm going to tell you what, we are smart enough not to buy into this. This is almost amazing. Which says Owatonna City Council and the Duluth City Council, you just keep right on spending 71%. We're going to keep sending you that money. You just keep doing anything you want with it. And by the way, your taxpayers, they're going to feel good because we're going to send them a few bucks back. I'm telling you, this is bait and switch. Bait and switch big time. I mean big time. We're now getting into the where all of a sudden people are starting to talk about $452 million in new taxes about like it's nothing. And I hope that there's people in this body that realize that people are not that stupid.
They cannot buy into this kind of thing that tells them that, you know what, here it comes, and you know what goes around comes around. I was on a city council. I was on a county board. I don't have any problems with LGA. But when somebody says, when somebody tells you that this bill is not just duping people, I find that hard to believe. I'm not going to talk anymore today. I've had my say here, but I will tell you something. Look at how schools are being funded. I sat in this body with Senator Moe in 2001, and I talked exactly about what somebody just had mentioned here about ag land. The reason I was all for us taking over school funding and taking it off the property tax rolls is because of agriculture land. And farmers that were out on their property were getting hit really, really hard when a school would try and pass a levy. And they would go and vote no. And a lot of us said, you know what, we got to change that a little bit and make it so there's equity and that people won't vote no on those levies. And so we put that in place. I talk to people, I sit in a coffee shop and I say, do you realize that the state picks up your school funding except for extra levy? A person sits in his home and he thinks his taxes is paying for his school and it's paying for his city. Think about it. Now, people will say, well, geez, now you're going against property tax reform and you're going to be against people. No, I just don't like bait and switch type stuff. If we're going to raise property taxes, or raise them. If we're going to lower them, lower them. But this whole bit about how we're doing it is wrong. Thanks.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, I think my head is still spinning from the Dick Day statistics. But I think we're making two mistakes with this legislation, Madam President. Two mistakes. The first is, and kind of the most basic, is it's May 10th. It's May 10th. And we're taking more time on the Senate floor today to talk about a bill that will not become law. This bill will not become law. It will have bipartisan opposition here. It had already bipartisan opposition on the House. And the governor will set a land speed record in vetoing this bill. So the clock is ticking. And we're not even sending something to the governor that he could consider. This is exactly what he has said he will veto. So I'm hoping we're going to start to get serious. I'm hoping we're going to start talking about targets. I think this might be an indication that the Tax Conference Committee maybe isn't going too well, that we have to go in this direction. But the other mistake, Madam President, besides just working on something that's not going to become law, the mistake is the message that it sends. The message that this bill sends is, we need to raise taxes. We need to raise income taxes. Now, it wouldn't be the highest rate in the nation, but it would create the third highest rate in the nation. So those people who earn incomes, those businesses, those small businesses who have more choices than ever, who can move quickly, who with the click of a mouse can move people and ideas and venture capital to other states and to other countries, they look at Minnesota and what do they see? Well, Minnesota, at least the legislature, wants to be the third highest income tax rate in the nation. So I worry that the damage is already being done because the message coming out of this body and out of this Capitol dome is that we need more. We need more from you. And Madam President, I don't think that's a winning strategy. I don't think that's a winning 21st century strategy for how do we grow businesses, how do we grow jobs, how do we get people to choose Minnesota? Not with this bill.
Is there further discussion? Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam President. And members, we heard this bill being described as this is not a tax increase. So we heard this bill described as. And I'd like to know, if this is not a tax increase, what does a tax increase look like? And Senator Michelle is right. This is the highest, I think, tax rate in Minnesota's history, if not the top three in the country. And I don't know, other than maybe Senator Murphy, who's told us here on the floor a couple of times that he went around and campaigned for high taxes in his district, I don't know of anyone in either party that campaigned last fall on coming to this body in a time of $2.2 billion surplus and having as their priority raising taxes on people of the state of Minnesota. And that's what this is. And I think Senator Day pointed out and Senator Ortman pointed out that people think, well, this is only going to be on a few people, 23,000 or 25,000 or whatever it is, just a few people. And I'd like to know, frankly, why we're doing that. I don't understand the philosophical idea behind saying, well, we've got a small percentage of people that earn a lot of income, this 1%, and let's raise taxes on them. And the only thing I can come up with is that because they have the money. And this is called fairness or progressivity. And we already have one of the steepest so-called progressive tax rates, income tax structures in the country. If you look at the 30% highest income earners in the state of Minnesota, and that's about a $60,000 a year income and above, everybody makes over $60,000 of income, you're in the 30% highest income earners in the state. And that group, that 30%, pays 83% of the income taxes in the state. 83%. That means the people that are in the 70% pay less than 20%. We already have a structure that says a high amount of tax revenue is generated by a very small number of people. If you look at that 1%, they pay 24% of the income taxes. 1% pay 24% of the income taxes. And we're saying that's not enough. 24% of the state income taxes paid by 1% of the people is enough. That 1% ought to pay more because that's fair. That's called fairness. I think it's interesting that, and people have pointed this out, that 1%, these are people that are typically small business owners. They're counting as income the income generated by their business. They are employing other people. They are employing lots of people. And as Senator Michelle pointed out, it is very easy for these people to decide they want to live somewhere else. And if one of those income earners did move to another state and took their income with them, it would take 280 households earning between $80,000 and $100,000 to replace the tax revenue from that one household in the top 1%. So one of those 23,000 that we think we're going to generate all this income from, if one of them decides to move to another state, we would have to attract 280 households in the $80,000 to $100,000 range to recover the income to the state from the loss of that one taxpayer. That's the impact that this has. This does not make any sense. This is not about fairness. This is about one thing. It's about the idea that the people that have some money, whether they're business people or otherwise, but the people that are earning higher incomes ought to pay more than they already pay, which is very substantial. And we shouldn't forget this. We talked about when this country was founded that we ought to have a system that says no taxation without representation. We linked the idea of representation to taxation. When you look at the kind of structure that we're putting in place today, we're turning that on its head. Why is it fair to say that 1% of the population ought to pay 1/4 of the cost of government? Why is that fair? Why should 30% of the population pay nothing? Why should that be fair? I think if we want to talk about reforming the tax structure in Minnesota, we ought to do that. And I think there's a lot of people that would be willing to enter that debate from all kinds of perspectives and say, how can we make a tax system that really does reflect the idea that everyone ought to have a stake in what we're spending money on? But that's not what this does. And I think one of the more pernicious things is what Senator Ortman pointed out. We're putting in place, furthering a structure that already is removing responsibility and accountability from local units of government. Minnesota, just in the case of schools, Minnesota, I think, is the number one or maybe the number two state in the country in the percentage of school funding that is supplied by the state. To say that the bulk of school funding is supplied by local taxation is just not true. Most of the funding comes from state taxpayers, the highest in the country. So members, this is a very bad idea. This is the Minnesota mistake. And again, if this is not a tax increase, I'd like to see what one is. What do you call a tax increase if that's not what this is? This is what it is. It's a mistake. And as Senator Michelle said, it's going nowhere. Let's vote it down and be done with it.
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam President. I think I heard Senator Hand say that this is the highest income tax rate that we've ever had in this state. And if I didn't hear you right, I want to apologize for that. But I think that's what I heard. And Just want to give members a little tax, I'm not going to call it advice, but the Department of Revenue publishes this little Minnesota tax handbook. And it's a nice, handy little reference guide that members of the tax committee use all the time. And it has lists in it, all the different taxes that we impose in the state of Minnesota and some history on them. And Senator Hahn, I just want to remind you, when I went through the Minnesota tax handbook here and looked at income taxes, in 1977, we had an income tax rate of 16%, one of 17%, and we had an income tax rate of 18%. And this rate of 9 is half of what the highest income tax bracket was in 1977. And Madam President, as long as I have the floor, Senator Day did a very eloquent job of doing the annual thing that gets done. It's usually done in tax committee, not on the floor, comparing property taxes on the Senate floor. But when he got to the education part, I was a little bit troubled, because when all of us are sworn in, we all agree to uphold the Constitution. And I think from time to time it's a good idea for us to be reminded of Section 1 in Article 13. You know, when Senator Day said that, geez, in these school districts all over the state is paying for 70% of the cost of schools. And what it says in the Constitution now, it is the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools. The legislature shall make such provisions by taxation or otherwise as will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools throughout the state. And Madam President, that is what we do. That is what we do. And Senator Day is probably right. We probably have schools all over the state where the state pays for 70% of the cost of the schools, and I think Owatonna was one of his examples, and I thank him for bringing that up. But members, that is not a bad thing. That's our duty under the Constitution, to provide for public education. And are there different funding levels in different school districts? Yes, because there's different tax capacities in different districts. Some districts can raise additional money really easily because they have a lot of tax capacity. Others don't. But it's our duty to provide a uniform system in the Constitution. That means it shouldn't matter where you live. It shouldn't matter if you live in Grand Marais, where the fire is burning today, or you live in Owatonna in Senator Day's district. It's a uniform system. And in a uniform system, that means the same opportunity. In some districts, that's going to mean our responsibility is to level the playing field where that property tax wealth is not there. That's our constitutional duty. And I think from time to time, it's good that we remind ourselves of that. And we do that, as it says in the Constitution, through taxation. That's how we do it. And Senator Day, I actually want to thank you for bringing forward those remarks on school funding, because I think from time to time, members, it's a good thing for us to be reminded that we have a constitutional obligation to make sure that we fund schools.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam President. There are some questions we should always ask ourselves when legislation comes in front of us. Sometimes when we look at legislation, we should ask the question, what's next? When we begin to regulate things, what are we going to regulate next and to what extent? This bill begs a different question. This bill begs the question, who's next? Because it is a matter of who's next. Don't fool yourselves, people, and don't try to fool the people of Minnesota that are smarter than that. In this particular bill, we may well only to increase the taxes of what we might want to call the most wealthy in the state, but who's next? There's a disparity in this bill in what the income it generates for the state versus what the program costs in the out years. Who's next? Look around you, because if you earn $60,000 and your neighbor earns $40,000, you're next. Because we're going to need more money to cover this cost. And then look around you, because if you earn $50,000 and your neighbor earns 30, you're next, because we have to cover the cost of this bill. Most things roll downhill or slide downhill, and this one will roll or slide downhill. So if you have a neighbor or a friend or a family member or anybody, look out. You're next, because we have to pay for what we do here, and there's a disparity in the out years. And so all of a sudden, it won't be just the top income earners. It'll be you. Your income tax will go up. And then when we can't do that enough, then property taxes will go up some more. And then sales taxes will go up. If government continues down the path of more money, more money, more money, more money, somebody has to pay. And folks, that's you, the citizen. So don't be fooled. Because when we do bills like this, where we redistribute the wealth in Minnesota, all we're doing is saying, look out, you're next. We're coming to get your money too.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a new legislator. I'm a freshman legislator, and there was clearly in the last election a message that the public wanted us to come here this year and get something done, to get something done for education, to get something done for transportation, to get something done in the area of health care, and to get something done so that they could have some property tax relief. There's no question that those were the message that there needed to be action. We've had a number of bills come before this body that have already been vetoed by the governor, and vetoed on the basis that there were things in this bill that the governor did not get on the one hand, even though most of those bills provided substantially for the interests of the governor and his budget, and on a secondary basis, that he's concerned about the overall cost of the government's proposals and his inability to determine whether or not we'd be able to afford them. This is one bill, and I want the Senate to understand that clearly does not increase taxes. What it talks about is how we collect revenues and how are we going to give property tax relief, which is something that the people that elected us have asked us to do. And the way in which this is being proposed to be done is to ask those who are in the higher income brackets to pay their fair proportion of their income for government services. And although we're talking about how much of the overall cost of government is paid by this bracket, what is not being said is that when you take a look at the percent of their income, when you take a look at what the percentage is of their income, under the current situation, they're paying less than the middle class. And even with this increase, they will continue to be paying less than the middle class. So what this is not about is not a tax increase. I want the people that I'm representing to know to not buy that message because it's invalid. What it is about is a different way of collecting revenue, and it's a way in which we are able to give property tax relief to people who are in our communities when their incomes are not growing with the cost of inflation, when their incomes are fixed, when their property values are not such that they can very easily raise income. So what we are doing in this bill is shifting back to a progressive system. It collects enough revenue to give property tax relief without reducing the overall or increasing the overall revenue stream. Thank you.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Bach said that the last time we had a tax rate that was higher was 1977. And I'm not planning on bringing in platform shoes and a leisure suit anytime soon or breaking out any disco records, but I do remember the economic conditions a bit. I think gas prices might be parallel there, but certainly we had economic times of double-digit inflation, certainly double-digit taxes. And I don't think that's the direction we want to go. I don't think it is. Why would we want to turn the clock back? Why do we want to go back to the 1970s in that sort of economic environment? But when this bill was introduced to us on the floor today here, Senator Bach said he had a soundbite to describe it, and honestly, it wasn't very compelling. I don't even remember what it was. I don't know if anybody remembers his opening remarks, but I've got one for you. A DFL tax plan, tax and budget plan, raising taxes, killing jobs. That's all you need to know. These bills are coming to us piecemeal, puzzle pieces by puzzle pieces. And individually, you can argue, well, this one is an offset. This one is revenue neutral. This one doesn't raise taxes. It reduces here, whatever it is. But when you put the piecemeal pieces of the puzzle together, you put it together and you have a picture of a DFL tax and budget plan that simply is raising taxes, killing jobs. Members, put the pieces of the puzzle together. You know, a lot of times, some of these bills are coming up, and it's also said that you know, where we're offsetting, okay, today, we're offsetting property taxes with income tax increases. The fact is, all of these things are fungible. These dollars go into the general fund, and they're turned around and churned around and spent on different things through all of the spending bills. That's how it's done. There's no way to guarantee exactly how these things are all going to come out in the end. We don't even have a target for E12, I don't believe, yet, or anything that I'm aware of. So how are we going to make all this work out? You know, we have a multi-billion dollar surplus. Even if you factor in the inflation that we dispute about or argue about, even if you factor in all the entitlement spending and spend those surplus dollars, the additional tax dollars that have come in through growth in the economy, if you spend all that, in the end, we're going to be growing government by nearly 10%. The governor has said that's enough. I say that's more than enough. I say a 10% growth in state government spending over this coming biennium is more than enough. That's it. We don't need all these piecemeal tax bills coming forth to grow government by even more. The DFL tax plan is about raising taxes, killing jobs. Instead, we need to grow our economy.
Senator Tomassoni.
Thank you, Madam President. You know, I'm sitting here listening to this, and I probably wouldn't be up right now if Senator Day hadn't once again mentioned my district, but Senator Day, I'm beginning to think you live in La La Land, because I'm really glad that Senator Bach read from the Constitution, because public schools mean just that. It means the public pays for them. And the way that the public pays for public schools is through taxation. And the most important thing about our public schools in this state is that they're fair and equitable. And the reason that some districts get more state money than other districts get is because they can't raise the money themselves. If Hibbing increases its levy by 1%, they can raise $39,000. If Edina increases their levy by 1%, they can raise $1.5 million. Now, I don't begrudge Edina for being property tax rich, but I do want the kids in my districts to have exactly the same educational opportunities that everybody else in the state has, and that's what fair and equitable is all about. You know, the message that this bill is sending is that the only bait and switch that's going on around here is that the Pawlenty administration for the last 5 years has been telling people that he hasn't raised their taxes. But we got $2.3 billion in property tax increases. We got over $1 billion in fees going up to manage this administration. And to say that taxes haven't gone up, well, I don't know where you come from, but where I come from, if you take a buck out of my left pocket or if you take a buck out of my right pocket, it's still a buck. And these taxes have been going up as a result of the Pawlenty administration's policies to make sure that property taxes go up because they're taking away money from the general fund. And the places can't afford it. Our school districts are having to increase their class sizes. They're having to cut teachers. They're having to cut programs. Tuitions have gone up anywhere from 65% to 80% at our colleges. Kids are coming out of our colleges with mortgages to pay, but they don't own a house because their tuition is so high. And to tell me that this is a bait and switch, the only bait and switches that have been going on is that the Pawlenty administration has been telling everybody that they're not raising their taxes. But I'm going to tell you what, tuition goes up, that's a tax. Cigarette fees, maybe you call them, I don't know if you call them a tax. I call 75-cent tax on a pack of cigarette a tax. Okay, I don't care what anybody else around here calls it, I call it a tax. Taxes have gone up under the Pawlenty administration. They've gone up substantially. And what this bill does is it takes a revenue neutral dollar for dollar and it goes into property tax relief, property taxes that have gone up as a result of the Pawlenty administration's bait and switch on their policies.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam President. I received an email from a constituent that has a story written by Dr. David Kamershan, and we can relate to it. He puts it in layman's terms about 10 guys who go to the bar, and they like to go there and have beers, and they decide to divide the bar bill up according to the way we pay income taxes. So the first four men who have the lowest income, they pay nothing. The fifth pays a dollar, the sixth pays $3,
the
seventh pays $7, the eighth pays $12. They have a $100 bill when they go there every night. I know they probably each have so many beers, and the bar bill is $100. The eighth pays $12, the ninth pays $18, the tenth man, the richest, pays $59. And they agree that that's okay, that that's the way they're going to do it. But then one day the bar owner says, you know, because you're such good customers, I'm going to reduce your bar bill $20. So now you're only going to have to pay $80. So now they're trying to figure out how they're going to equitably adjust that. And so they decide that, well, we'll just take an even amount. There's six of us paying. We'll still let the other four not pay. And we'll take an even amount and divide that among us, that $20. So they each are going to pay $3.33 less. But then next thing that happens, they were kind of debating that, and the bar owner comes out, and he suggests this. The fifth man, like the first four, would now pay nothing. So he has 100% savings. The sixth man now paid $2 instead of $3, so he has a 33% savings. The seventh now pays $5 instead of $7, so he has a 28% savings. The eighth now pays $9 instead of $12, so he has a 25% savings. And the ninth man now pays $14 instead of $18 for a 22% savings. The tenth man now pays $49 instead of $59, which is a 16% savings. It's the smallest percent of savings, but the biggest amount of money. And so they agree that, you know, they're all better off than they were before, but well, when they get outside, they said, the one man says, wait, I only got a dollar out of the $20. And he pointed to the tenth man, but he got $10. Yeah, that's right, explained the fifth man. I only saved the dollar, too. It's unfair that he got 10 times more than I. That's true, shouted the seventh man. Why should he get $10 back when I got only $2? The wealthy get all the breaks. And they got into this big squabble, and the 9 other men surrounded the tenth man and beat him up. The next night, the tenth man didn't show up for drinks, so the 9 sat down and had beers without him. But when it came time to pay the bill, they discovered something important. They didn't have enough money between all of them for even half of the bill. And that is the story that we can be looking at here today. We don't have to drive many people away, and we won't have enough money to pay the bill either. And, you know, there's a lot of options that folks in that upper income bracket have. And they can move to another state. They can even go international with their businesses. And so that's what happens when we think about redistributing the wealth even in a greater fashion than we do now. We already do have a progressive system. And so we may end up like the 10 guys at the 9 guys at the bar. One doesn't show up anymore, and they don't even have enough to pay half the bill anymore.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sitting with Senator Jungbauer at the only bipartisan desk in the Senate. And we have a lot of conversations back and forth here quite a bit. And it's a, I have a great seatmate, and I would just like to say thank you to whoever decided to pair us up here. I think I've told some of you this before, but I'm also married to a Republican. I've been married to him for 30 years. Maybe that's why we got paired up here, Michael. So what I want to say is people stand up and say what they believe from a real strong personal sense of their own core values. And I think we need to respect each other's opinion because I know my husband is not evil and stone-hearted. And he knows I'm not soft-handed and can't say no. So we just have different perspectives on the same issue. But I've been listening to some of the questions. Senator Hahn was wondering, why is this fair? He said he doesn't get it. And Senator Day was asking, who are these people? Who are these top-tier, fourth-tier people? And who's going to be next? Hear from Senator Worgen. I would just stand up here and say that my husband and I are in that fourth tier. And I went to Senator Bach and several members of the tax committee early on, and I said, please raise the taxes on the wealthiest people in Minnesota. Because when I was out there door knocking all summer and all fall, I knocked on so many households' doors, I could not afford to pay an extra $10 a month. I talked to farmers who would like to support their local school referendums, but they can't because all that money goes onto their agricultural land. There are so many senior citizens in my district that are on fixed incomes, and I'm watching property taxes increase up around their ears. And people who are not able to afford health care anymore, because the health care crisis is a huge cost crisis in Minnesota. So, yes, to some of you who wondered, have we talked about increasing taxes in Minnesota? And I would say, yes, I did that. I ran on five issues: strong schools, veterans protection, lowering property taxes, affordable health care, and energy independence. And when we talked about how to get there, we did talk about the need for investing in some of these initiatives. And I would talk about progressive taxation, which is not an idea that I had. It's not an idea that's even 20 years old or 40 years old. Actually, and I've said this to some of the people in my caucus, this is a moral issue for some of us who believe in progressive taxation. And you can trace the idea of progressive taxation back to biblical times. He to whom much is given, much is expected. And Madam Chair, I'm very happy to suggest that you raise taxes on the wealthiest Minnesotans and wealthiest Americans, because we do have more. I can pay that extra $10 a month or $100 a month. And I'm not going to not pay the people that I support with my husband and my family's income. I'm not going to move jobs overseas or out of the state. I grew up in Minnesota when we did have a much higher tax rate. My parents paid that so I could go to school, private school in those days, and only pay $7,000 a year. We are standing on the shoulders of a generation before us who were willing to make sure that Minnesota had good roads and good, strong schools. And if we're talking about half the tax rate that we're paying today compared to our parents and grandparents, I think that's an okay thing. We need to keep it in context. We have to be sensible with how we spend those tax dollars, be responsible, be very careful. But it's okay to ask me to pay a little bit more money, because I know there are many, many people out there who, if their taxes went up one more year, would have to decide whether to buy milk for the week or whether they could fill their prescriptions. So it is an okay thing, in my opinion. This is a moral issue, and I thank Senator Bach and his committee for looking to the people who have much to support Minnesota.
Senator Youngbauer.
Thank you, Madam President. And yes, I have a lot of fun sitting in the bipartisan seat as well. We do get to discuss things, and I think for the most part, all of us legislators want some of the same ends. It's just, how do we get there? And you know, on this issue, to say that we're going to have property tax reform on this issue and in this manner is a total sham. In order to figure out property tax reform, members, we need to figure out where is the biggest cost to our cities and our counties. What's the cost driver? And we need to be involved there. And no matter where you go in the state of Minnesota, the either number one or number two cost driver in every community and every county is transportation issues, road issues. So the only person that could argue that they're actually doing property tax reform might be Senator Murphy, who could argue that he's trying to get a lot more money for transportation, because that would truly make a significant difference on property tax in Minnesota. Members, we should have put 100% of the surplus into roads. We should have made things simple this year instead of arguing for hours and hours ad nauseum on things that we know are going to get vetoed. Our constituents get it. Senator Wergen said it earlier. I had a conversation with a gal the other night, and she said she went home to her husband and talked to him and said, you know, I don't really mind what's going on, that they might raise taxes on those wealthy people. And she said her husband looked at her and kind of crossed his eyes up and said, you know, baby, you just don't get it. They're coming after us. It's never enough money. They're going to come and get it from us sometime, someplace, and that's how our constituents perceive it. So members, if we're really concerned about property tax relief, we need to fund transportation. Maybe not the way the bill is coming out. I'm not sure I can agree with it. But that's where our time and our effort needs to go if we want to make a difference on property tax. And perhaps my friend Senator Bach might just retitle this bill the Robin Hood Bill, as it robs from the rich and gives to the poor.
Senator Olson M.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd first like to thank Senators Sharon and Senators Erickson Ropes. As fellow freshman senators, we've had a lot of conversation in caucus and on the floor and between ourselves privately about our passion to achieve the goals that we believe our constituents sent us here to achieve and how we're going to get there. And while we may all say that we share those goals and that our differences are about how do we go about achieving these goals, I think the one core thing we owe our constituents, all of us, is that we tell the truth about the fact that everything we do costs money and that the money has to come from somewhere. If we are going to provide for more money for nursing homes, if we're going to provide money for roads, if we're going to provide money for education, if we're going to provide money for health care, the money has to come from somewhere. I had a conversation with a constituent recently who wanted to talk to me about the gas tax, and I agreed with him wholly that this is a poor time, on top of the exorbitant profits that the oil companies are extorting from our constituents, that we should have to add a nickel or a dime on top of that. And I agree the timing is terribly poor. But the fact is that we have four choices when it comes to transportation, as with all other issues. We can increase what's been a flat tax that hasn't risen in 20 years. We can tax it some other way, find a different tax so that we can somehow try to say we're not raising the taxes. We can borrow the money, which is bonding, I guess, or we can just ignore the problem and not take care of our roads. I wish there were a better choice. But honestly, if we're honest with the taxpayers, just like with their personal budgets and their businesses, sometimes we have to make hard choices, and it's not fair to pretend to the taxpayers that those choices don't have to be made. We can't say we support something and then not provide the funding to support it. Now, in terms of fairness, it's really not fair to taxpayers when we're playing games back and forth with percentages versus whole numbers, and we hear stories about that will present a certain image in a certain way. But if we really want to talk about what's fair, we have to compare either dollars or we have to compare percentages. Otherwise, we're really mixing things up in a way that isn't logical. For example, with Senator Hand's analogy, if we carried it out to its extreme logically, we'd say then everyone should only have to pay $1 or $50 or $100, and we wouldn't have any progressive taxation. So the point is, I think if we're going to look at what's fair from a percentage standpoint, and that's where the Senate has been coming from this year, we want to equalize the percentage that people are paying across the board. We all know that the middle class, that there's been a growing disparity between the middle class and those at the top income levels, and that's because the tax cuts in recent years have tended to favor those in those in the highest income levels in comparison to the middle class. So what we're trying to do is even out that disparity in a way that more closely brings back the overall percentage of taxes, not just income taxes, because that's only one form of taxes, but if we look at taxes across the board, everyone should be paying their fair share, which is the same fair percentage of responsibility for those things we say are important to us in this state.
Senator Vandeveer.
Well, thank you, Madam President. Senator Olson, your statement that tax cuts recently have favored the rich. I had a brochure that the DFL was handing out at the state fair after we passed those tax cuts, calling them across-the-board income tax cuts, with the largest cuts being in the middle-income wage earners. But anyway, we talk about asking this generation to do their part and pay more taxes like previous ones did. But I would remind you, I was looking over some statistics myself the other day. In the 50s, a typical family gave about 15% of their income to government. Today, a typical family pays about 40%. So I think it's an insult to taxpayers to imply that they're not doing their job, that they've been too tight, that they're not carrying their load, because they are certainly carrying their load, and my constituents are happy to do it, provided that we're being fair to them and that we're using the money wisely. But I can see, looking around and looking at this bill, that Minnesota is at it again. This is the politics of deception. What you do is you pick a small group to attack. 2 years ago, it was cigarette smokers. This year, it's the 93,000 people impacted by this bill. You take their money and confiscate it, and you give it to a larger group, buying enough votes for you to stay in office. It works for a period of time, but I would remind the people of Minnesota that, Chairman Bach yield for a question?
Senator Bach, do you yield? He does. Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you. Chairman Bach, is there any new capital gains tax rate in this bill, or have we done anything with that issue?
Senator Bach.
No, Madam President. Senator Vandeveer, the capital gains in relative to Minnesota taxation are taxed at the regular income tax rate.
Well, thank you, Chairman Bach. That's right. So if you're out there listening, thinking you're safe this time from the little scuds being launched out of here, I would, if you have a job, if you work, if you have assets, then I would remind you, you are a target, and they will get you, because they are sucking up all the money, and you're going to be in their way. So because you're going to get missed this time doesn't mean that you're safe, because when you sell your real estate, when you go to retire, if you have a small business, all of a sudden you are going to be in the 93,000. And everything you worked years and years and years for is going to be sucked up by the state of Minnesota, because you have something. And if you have it, we want it. So I would keep that in mind. Members, this is a job-killing tax increase. That's all it is. To say it, somebody said, what was that quote? Clearly does not increase taxes. Well, my handlers, or staff, or whatever we call them today, have a bill summary here, and it says the income tax provisions in this bill creates a new fourth bracket of 9.0% imposed for taxable, it doesn't say requested for, taxable year beginning after December 1st, 2006. It says imposed, so you're not asked to donate the 9%. But that sounds like an increase, because the bracket applies to single filers at taxable income of $226,230. and for married joint filers at $400,000. Now, unless this is a mistake, and are these handlers or staff? Does someone... I'm sorry, I think they're staff. Okay, this came from my research staff. If there's something wrong with this, let me know, but this sure looks like a job-killing tax increase to me. So, members, this is deception, pure and simple. To say that we're not raising taxes is simply false. It is the politics of deception. And you may think that 93,000 people isn't enough for you to lose your... office, but those 93,000 people, what you're doing to them is enough to hurt the state's economy, to cost us jobs, to cost us economic growth, and to severely impact our ability in the future to pay for services for seniors, schools, and roads. So I would ask you to vote no. There is no reason for Minnesota to move up in taxes in comparison to the rest of the country. Not when we have a $2 billion more that we can spend this year than we spent last year. So we need to vote no on this. Let's be honest with the public. Let's not deceive them this time. And let's just not pass this bill.
Senator Bach.
Well, Madam President, Senator Vandiver, for the sake of accuracy, let me remind members how many filers are affected by this. There are 20,700 residents who are going to be affected by this income tax increase. Senator Vandiver said there was 93,000. Members, that's just not accurate. You know, let's at least know what we're voting on here. The number is 20,700. Will they be unhappy? Some will. Senator Erickson-Ropes family might be affected, but I think she's indicated that that she supports it. And the other thing I'm troubled by, members, that I'm hearing on the floor, and I heard Senator Vandiver say it, and I heard it said a couple of times earlier, and I think, and it is, I don't know if I get this quite right, so I'll just paraphrase, they're gonna get you. They're gonna get you. I've heard that several times on the floor. Members, I need to remind everybody, government isn't some foreign entity from outer space. Government is us. Government is the means by which we collectively do for our communities what our individual citizens can't do for themselves. It's not some foreign space thing that comes in here in black helicopters and gets us. It's what we do collectively for our people. And I just want to remind people, because I've heard multiple times that, and that's, you know, that's troubling, I think, because government isn't the enemy. Government does a lot. We do a lot here to improve the lives of people across the state, and just want to remind people it's not some kind of a foreign invader that's going to somehow get us.
Senator Pogamiller.
Madam President, sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to give a heads up. Recall, members, that there's been a request by a group of members. They need to leave at about 12:30 or so. And so the process here will be, if we're able to wrap that up, that would be good. We would adjourn for the day. If not, we will recess and come back at 2:30. We'd come back at 2:30 then. And we can go either way. But if we could wrap up, if people are close on their comments, and if we could wrap that up now, we would adjourn for the day.
Is there further discussion on House File 2294? Senator Vandiver and then Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Bach, you're right. I apologize. I looked at the wrong numbers that my staff gave me. The Senate bill that went out apparently was the 93,000. The House was a little more cautious in who they attacked, and I think we took the House tax increase, and that only impacts 28,000 people. It's a smaller group, so a little safer politically, but just reemphasizes the point.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Roebling, from time to time, I actually frequent the bars in my district, and the patrons in those bars have been complaining about their property taxes going up. And the bottom line to this bill is that this bill will help reduce the property taxes of the patrons in my bars.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Madam President, members, we've been told that we're trying to keep the comments to a brevity. I will, too. This is the third DFL tax increase bill this year that we've now discussed on the Senate floor. This time, we've been told that this bill will lower property taxes, just like Senator Tomasoni has said. But we have to make sure that our eyes are wide open on this one. We will be raising taxes, there's no question about it, and we once again will be creating a fourth income tax tier in the state of Minnesota. You may remember tax bill, I think it was 2, raised that income tax proposal to the highest income tax rate in the country. Now we're being asked that this new tax rate will be just the third lowest or third highest, not the highest in the country, and we're supposed to be taking some type of solace in that. That is not the right direction for the state of Minnesota to go into. Now, I tried to look at that fourth income tax rate tier. What kind of people are they? Now, of course, we always know that if you're a director of a nonprofit corporation in the state of Minnesota, yes, you'll probably be clicked on that one. You will be a target of this new income tax. And if it's a nonprofit corporation that has something to do with some type of medical service, yes, you will be a target of this income tax. The other group of people will most likely be someone who owns a business, taking the risks, paying the rates of insurance, the worker comp, the unemployment insurance, the corporate income tax, capital gains taxes in the state of Minnesota, but more importantly, they will be providing jobs to our citizens. And once again, we keep hearing the refrain, Senator Gerlach said it best, keep raising taxes and we'll be killing jobs in the state of Minnesota. And this bill is no different. These people will either call it finally quits in Minnesota, move their business, move their jobs, and we will continue to lose an income tax, perhaps a sales tax that would purchase the capital. Investments in those corporations would suddenly cease, and we no longer have the robust economy in the state of Minnesota that we once did. The other side of curing that problem for that potential employer is simply to add that high income tax cost onto every product that they make. So, what does that mean? It's just a de facto tax on the consumer once again, because the taxes get put on to every product that they sell in the state of Minnesota. This third DFL tax increase bill is flawed. We're going in the wrong direction. The third highest taxed income tax in the country is not the place to be for the state of Minnesota. Senator Bach, you made a historical reference to 1977. There's another historical reference that I'd like you to know about. 1977, we had a 16% income tax by your records. What happened in 1978, the very next year? 1978, gee, the DFL governor no longer, or the governor never, or was not held by a governor in 1978 by the DFL party. Al Quie was elected in 1978. The Minnesota House changed drastically. It was called a Minnesota massacre when taxes went too high in 1977. 1978 had another day in history. Now we're debating the same issue in 2007, and guess what's going to happen in 2008? An election is coming. I'm just amazed that we have to keep repeating history like this all the time. We've been told almost with a Lake Wobegon-esque character that this bill is good for Minnesota. It's not good for Minnesota unless it treats everyone in Minnesota the same. And this bill definitely does not, by increasing taxes on a few to pay for the many. That isn't the character of Minnesota, and it never should be. We have an element of this small percentage of taxpayer that's paying exorbitant amounts of our income tax in the state of Minnesota. And for some of you, you just want more. There's no satisfying you. You just want more. You just want more services. You just want more government product being put into the system all the time. And our income tax keeps going up. Our property taxes come and go. We shift them around. I think Senator Day said it right. Bait and switch. But I think, Senator Day, you missed a few other comments. Smoke and mirrors comes to mind. Voodoo economics comes to mind. And, of course, the ever popular shell game comes to mind on this particular tax bill.
Mr. President. Madam President.
Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I'll be very, very brief. We've had a good debate here today on this particular bill. We're going to move on now to the vote. But, again, this bill is all about taxing the rich. It's an old-fashioned idea. It's a dangerous idea. It's an idea that long-term doesn't work because your rich do, in fact, move on. This bill is headed for veto land. We all know that. And we'll see it or something like this, I suppose, at some point. I would urge a no vote on this bill. Thank you.
Senator Bach.
Madam President, I'd like to impose a call of the Senate.
Senate's under call. Senator Bach.
Madam President, I move that those not voting be excused from voting. Oh, excuse me. Well, that's close. The Sergeant-at-Arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
On the motion, all those in favor, please say aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Madam President, is this a roll call vote? Or if not, I would request one.
Senator Senjum, we are on special order, so there is a roll call vote. Senator Day.
Madam President, I will be really short and quick, and I hope members realize that we're not a second-class state when it comes to taxes. Our budget is $34 billion every 2 years. Wisconsin is $27 billion every 2 years. They have 480,000 more people than we do. Their budget is $7 billion less. This isn't about wealthy people. Forget the wealthy people. I don't even know them. This is about Tomasoni. He keeps talking. I'm going to tell you, it's about in Minnesota, K-12 education. The state pays 80%. It's the third highest percentage of any state in the country. We pick up 80% of our schools. There's 47 states underneath us. That isn't on property tax. Local government. I've heard from people that have cities that are even down in my area. They don't care if their city council raises the taxes 8, 10, 20% on a city council. They don't care. That's really bad. That's what's bad. That's the bait and switch. And we're saying we're going to send you $200 back. We should somehow, if we're going to do something, cap those people. We're in communities that when you look at how we fund the schools and when you look at how we're paying for local government aid and cities aid, it just doesn't make sense. I hope that people don't buy into this, because the people that are sitting out here watching this, your taxes are going to rise. Senator Day's name, nor is anybody else in this body's name on your property tax statement when you get it. It's the cities. It's levies of extra in the schools. The state isn't on it. So please don't buy into this bait and switch bill.
The Secretary will give House File 2294 its third reading.
House File 2294, a bill for an act relating to taxation modifying the levy authority of the Crookmore Hospital District, etc.
The Secretary will take the roll. The Secretary will close the roll. There being 35 ayes and 31 noes, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Senator Pogamiller.
Madam President, I'd like a brief recess for purposes of appointing a conference committee.
The Senate is in recess.
Mr. President.
Senate will be in order. Senator Pogamiller.
Mr. President, are there any privilege reports at the desk?
There's a privilege report at the desk.
Senator Pogamiller from the Subcommittee on Conference Committees recommends the following senators be and hereby appointed as a Conference Committee on Senate File 1165, Senators Olsen, Olson M., and Limmer. Senator Pogamiller moves the foregoing appointments be approved.
On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
What do you got left there?
Mr. President, is there any other work at the desk?
That completes the work at the desk, Senator Pogamiller.
Okay, then announcements, Mr. President.
Without objection. Without objection, Senator Stumpfwald, aide, Senator Murphy, from 10 to 12:35, Senator Vandeveer from 10 to 11, Senator Sharon from 10 to 10:40. Further announcements? Senator Senja.
Mr. President, Senate Republicans will meet in the state office building and decide where to go out to eat.
Just Republicans?
Mr. President, we still have the membership drive going on.
Our members that voted red are invited. Senator Bach? Senator Bach?
Mr. President, the Conference Committee on the Omnibus Tax Bill will meet shortly after the House adjourns.
Mr. President, members, for planning purposes, I don't think we should come back for confirmations today, so we'll do those tomorrow. The ones that I listed earlier, we'll do those tomorrow. We'll do the calendar tomorrow. I think we'll probably do Senate File 6 tomorrow. And so I think if we are able to process that, those items, we perhaps will not meet on Saturday. The full Senate will not meet. Conference committees will meet. And we will probably do the smoke-free Minnesota Conference Committee report tomorrow. So I think I'm inclined to start at 9 a.m. And that way, if we have a productive morning and no Saturday session, that would allow some members to who are not necessarily here, like the Tax Conference Committee will be here, the Education Conference Committee will be here. So I think that could work. So why don't we try 9 in the morning?
Senator Olson.
Mr. President, Senator Pogamiller, does that mean that Senator Dibble, who has been working hard to get our transit subcommittee out to see Taxi 2000 at 9 o'clock tomorrow, will have to cancel? I think within I don't know if he can move it up a little earlier, but we could maybe be back by 10:30 or even if we're there an hour. Would you consider that? We've been trying hard to find the time to do it.
So Mr. President, then based on a conversation with Senator Olson, apparently some members won't be here till maybe 10 or 10:30. So we will meet at 9, process items, and then hold more consequential votes until 10 or 10:30. And we could do debates and so forth. So the hope would still be to process the morning fairly orderly, and I don't know if we could be out of here by noon or not. But, we'll stay as long as we need to. And as of now, we would not be meeting Saturday. That does not mean that if something happened today or tomorrow where it was necessary to meet Saturday, we would meet Saturday. But as of right now, I think it looks like we probably will not meet in the full Senate on Saturday. So, Mr. President, I would move.
Before I get, Senator Olson has another question.
Mr. President, and members, I don't know if Senator Rest is standing for the same reason, but I believe that the Minnesota Sesquicentennial Commission is also planning to have cake here to celebrate Statehood Day tomorrow. And it will be either in the retiring room or in 237 tomorrow, so that for a period of time, so that we can enjoy that as we launch into the 150th year of our state.
Okay, Senator Sedgham.
Mr. President, and the Majority Leader, would you be able to tell us at this point when we might expect the Transportation Committee conference report?
Mr. President.
Senator Pogamiller.
Senator Sedgham, as I understand it, I don't see Senator Murphy, but they are reviewing the conference report. And when that conference report is done, the Senate would like to take it up as soon as it can. And it's a House file. So if the House processes it, we will process it as soon as possible. That's what leads me to say that it's possible we would meet Saturday. Because if the House processes the transportation bill, I believe the Senate will meet Saturday.
Senator Pogemiller, Senator Rest.
Mr. President, I just want to remind the members, too, of the State and Local Government Committee that we do have a meeting tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. to hear the pension bill and Senator Larson's bill. So please keep that in mind as you construct your Friday schedule.
So, Mr. President, Senator, I would move the Senate adjourn until Friday, May 11th, 9 a.m. And Senator Bedsold says that's statehood day.
Okay, that's good to know. On the motion to adjourn till 9 o'clock Friday morning. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. The Senate stands adjourned.